Revelation, but this is something related to the tribulation, related to the coming of the Lord, which is the main subject of the book of Revelation. And in the book of Revelation chapter 13, which is where we were up to, is the introduction to the beast, the Antichrist. He shows up in Revelation chapter 13. So we've been looking at, over the last few Wednesday nights when I spoke, quite a few Wednesday nights, on the evidence that we have that we are living in that last generation before the coming of Jesus Christ. And in Matthew chapter 24, we'll just look at these verses real fast, and then we're going to go on with our study tonight. Matthew chapter 24, look at verse number 32. The Lord said, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation, the generation that sees that happen, will be the generation in which all these things of Matthew chapter 24 will be fulfilled." And Matthew chapter 24 involves the Lord's own prophecy concerning his coming and the tribulation, the Antichrist, and all of those things. So the generation that sees this happen, the fig tree putting forth its branches putting forth leaves, not fruit yet, but leaves, that generation would be the generation that sees these things happen. And back when we first began this study, we looked in the scriptures at what a generation involves, and there are some that believe it's 40 years, some that believe it's 100 years, but the Bible's pretty clear that a generation is 70 years. All right, so the generation that sees that fig tree putting forth its branches and its leaves, and the fig tree in the scriptures always represents Israel, so it seems to be a prophecy on the part of Jesus Christ of Israel beginning to grow again as a nation. And so that nation was reestablished by decree of the UN. It was established in 1947, and then it actually became a nation in May of 48. But 1947, November of 47, is when the UN decreed that. And you notice in the scriptures that many times God begins counting from the going forth of the commandment, from the time of the decree. And the UN declared Israel to be a nation legally in November of 1947. So we're not counting years or trying to do the math or anything necessarily, but this study has been, can we really know for sure that that's what this is talking about? Can we really know for sure that the generation in which you and I are living is the generation that will see the coming of Jesus Christ? I mean, people and preachers and churches have been hoping for that and preaching that for 2,000 years. But is this really, are we really the generation that is going to see the coming of Jesus Christ? And so what we've been looking at are 20 evidences in the Bible, 20 evidences not just in the scriptures, but 20 evidences from just history and the world around us that we are that last generation, that this generation will see the coming of Jesus Christ. All right, the things we've looked at so far, I think we're up to number 15, but I'll just run through the first 14 real fast for those of you that haven't been here for a lot of this. The first thing is, as according to Matthew chapter 24, is the rebirth of Israel. In other words, the fig tree is beginning to grow. The second thing was the massive immigration of Jews back to Israel. That has all happened since 1947. Also in this generation, Israel, which was once a desert, a wilderness, has begun to blossom like a garden. If you go there or seen pictures of Israel today, it's a very fruitful and green country. It's no longer a desert. The fourth thing is that biblical cities, historic cities that were mentioned in the Bible that pretty much disappeared over the last 2,000 years. They were just destroyed, left in ruins. Many of those cities have been rebuilt, and even some of them have their biblical names again. And so that's a fulfillment of prophecy. Hebrew has been revived as a language. It was a dead language for 1,800 years. After the destruction of Jerusalem and the Jews being dispersed, they took up the language of the countries that they lived in, and Hebrew was forgotten. It wasn't studied, it wasn't spoken, but in this generation, Hebrew has been revived as a language, and it's the language of Israel today. Also, number six, the shekel, the Jewish unit of currency, which was also not in use for 1,600 or 1,700 years, has been restored, and that's the currency of Israel today. Number seven, Israel has been victorious in all her wars thus far since she became a nation. Number eight, according to Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 25, in the day of the Lord, the great towers would fall. And beginning with the Twin Towers in 2001, and obviously in the day of the Lord's return and in the time of the tribulation, towers would be falling. And there are over 100 skyscrapers around the world, most of them, by the way, in Islamic countries, that are over a quarter of a mile high. That's incredible. All right, number nine, the great falling away. In other words, Christian apostasy, the lukewarmness of the Laodicean church has only gotten worse and worse. And that's an indication because the Bible speaks about a falling away in the last days. That was number nine. Number 10, a proliferation of all the false Bibles, a famine in the land for the Word of God, over 100 false Bibles. And that's a fulfillment of prophecy. Number 11, the ecumenical movement. We won't spend any time on that. Number 12, the formation of the European Union, which took place in 1957. All the nations that were formerly the Holy Roman Empire in Europe are together again as one constitutional entity. Number 13, worldwide anti-Semitism, a hatred all over this world for Israel and the Jews, and that's pretty universal, and even America is slowly turning against them. Number 14 was America's moral collapse, and our nation's spiritual decay is also a fulfillment of prophecy, and we looked at that before. All right, and then so in the last few weeks, we've been looking at number 15, which is the resurgence of a militant Islam, the resurgence of a militant Islam, the rise of Muslim religion with a goal of world conquest, a goal to establish a worldwide Islamic caliphate. A caliph in the Quran is, Bobby, you have a key to my office. You want to get my office? Right about chest high on the shelf on the right is a copy of the Quran, and I need that for the part of the lesson here tonight. In the Quran, the word caliph, or caliph, I don't know how it's pronounced, is basically a successor to Muhammad. Muhammad, who started Islam in the 7th century, died in 632. And his successors, those men that would rule the Islamic world after him, were called caliphs. And there's been a long history of worldwide Islamic ruler. It would be the equivalent, I guess, of an Islamic pope would be the caliph. And his power, his authority would be religious and political, and it would be recognized by Muslims. Since Muhammad, there have been four caliphates. A caliphate is basically the government of the caliph. After the death of Muhammad, and I just have done over the last number of weeks my own study on these things, but there have been, up until this time, there have been four Muslim caliphates in history. The first one was called the Rashidun Caliphate, and it was from the death of Muhammad and lasted about 30 years, 632 to 661. And that first caliphate is considered by Muslims today to be the golden era of Islam, because that was Islam's fastest expansion from basically Mecca and Medina, where Muhammad lived. Within 30 years, the Islamic religion took Persia Egypt, Iraq, Syria, North Africa, Sicily, Cyprus, Crete, and Rhodes. So the entire Fertile Crescent, even a part of Turkey, within 30 years. So it went from basically being confined to Mecca and Medina, the area where Muhammad lived, and he had only conquered Mecca in 630 AD and then died 2 years later. So his successors were the ones that expanded Islam all around the world. And there were four of them. It doesn't even matter about their names. But thank you. And but that 30-year period when Muhammad's companions, those first four caliphs, were men that had actually been with Muhammad from the beginning. There were a group of them, 10 in total, and they were almost like the 12 disciples in a sense. They were given like this holy status in Islam because they were the ones that had lived with Muhammad in the caves, been through all the trials, and they were like on this, they were on this pinnacle. They were held in great reverence by all the Muslims. And so one after the other, they were appointed. The first one was assassinated. The second one was assassinated. The third one was assassinated. And the fourth one, named Ali, was the only direct descendant of Muhammad. And when he was assassinated, the Islamic world split between the Sunnis and the Shia. And the followers of Ali became the Shiites, and the followers of the other three guys became the Sunnis. And so there's been that split ever since 661 in the Islamic world. Well, after the death of Ali, one of the other followers of Muhammad declared himself to be the caliph. And he was from the tribe of Umayyad. And so he established an Umayyad caliphate. He set up his capital in Damascus. And this Umayyad caliphate, beginning with this one particular man and his and the men that he appointed after him, each caliph, as he was about to die, would appoint the next one, or the people would vote on it and decide who the next caliph would be. But that second caliphate, the Umayyad caliphate, lasted until 750 A.D. And it was followed by another one called the Abbasid Caliphate. That one lasted 500 years until 1258 A.D. And the fourth one is the one that is going to become important in the Bible study tonight. The fourth one you've probably heard of, and that's the Ottoman Caliphate, or the Ottoman Empire, as it was called in history. The Ottomans were Turks from present-day Turkey, and the leader of the Ottomans was Osman, and the way his name was pronounced, it sounded Ottman like that, and thus the name of all of his descendants. He was a Turkish warrior. He was very, very, he was a military genius, and at the time, Byzantine, I hate to like pull all this history stuff, but it's, you know, to me it's fascinating, but when the Roman Empire collapsed, it continued, not in Rome, but it continued in Byzantium, in Constantinople, which is today Istanbul. But the Roman Empire, even though Rome collapsed, the Roman Empire continued for another 1,000 years in the eastern part of the empire, which was in Constantinople, a city built by Constantine, named after himself. It became the capital of the Roman Empire for another 1,000 years, even as Rome fell into decay and the Pope rose to power to take the place of the missing emperor, because the emperor moved everything to Constantinople. Well, Constantinople survived for a long, long time. It was overthrown in 1453 by the Ottomans. The Ottoman Turks besieged Constantinople, which was where the manuscripts of your King James Bible had been protected for generations, for hundreds of years. The Greek manuscripts had been kept in Constantinople. And when it wasn't Osman himself, but it was his great-grandson, Mehmed II. Anyway, doesn't matter these names. I can't pronounce half of them. But Mehmed II, the grandson, great-grandson of Ottman, he besieged Constantinople, the Christians fled, taking those manuscripts with them, by the way. And once those manuscripts in the 1400s came into Europe and men in universities got a hold of them, and they began to see that the scriptures were not confined to the Latin, that here were all these Greek manuscripts that had, which became the Textus Receptus and led to your King James Bible. So God used the Ottoman Empire, in a sense, to free up those manuscripts, and you and I ended up with the pure Word of God today, kind of like as a byproduct of all of that. But Constantinople fell, and the Ottomans made it their capital. Constantinople, which had been the capital of the Christian world in a sense for 1,000 years, now became the capital. It was renamed Istanbul, and it now became the capital of the Muslim world. And Mehmed's successor, his son, declared himself the caliph, and he was recognized as such by the Muslim world. And so that began the fourth Muslim caliphate. In other words, from Constantinople, they were governing the world. All the Muslims were subject to the caliph in Constantinople. And the Ottoman Empire ruled the Muslim world and expanded their kingdom. They controlled all of the Middle East, Persia, Syria, Iraq, Egypt, the Sudan, Ethiopia, Libya, all the way around the coast. They controlled Cyprus. They controlled Sicily. They even reached into Europe. And Islam, the Ottoman version of Islam. Now, the Ottomans were Turks. They weren't Arabs. They were Turks. The Turks were from, like, where all the stands are, Turkestan, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan. All the stands were the Turkic people back in ancient times. And anyway, but they were driven down into the area that is today Turkey, but their empire reached all the way into Europe, because Constantinople, if you look on a map, is actually not in Asia, it's in Europe. It's on, you know, on this, it's a part of the European continent. But the Muslim religion spread all through Greece, into the Balkans, into Romania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Serbia. You remember the wars in Serbia 15 or 20 years ago. That was all Muslim area because of the Ottomans. So under the Ottomans, Islam had its furthest extent. So the Muslim empire was maybe not, it wasn't the glory days, the golden years, but it encompassed more of the world than in any other time. But because it was so big, it was also very weak. And slowly, its authority and its power eroded. So, but in 1517, interestingly, the Ottomans conquered Jerusalem. And so Jerusalem came under the authority of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Caliphate, beginning in 1517. It was liberated from the Ottomans exactly 400 years later, 1917, by the British. General Allenby, if you remember history, he rode into Jerusalem and, you know, liberated it from the Ottomans. Well, in World War I, the Ottomans, unfortunately or fortunately, picked the wrong side in World War I. They sided with the Germans. And when Germany lost, as a result of all the peace treaties after World War I, the Ottoman Caliphate and the Ottoman Empire was broken up. They were the losers. They picked the loser, and they suffered along with the Germans. And as a result of the peace treaties afterwards, all of the Ottoman Empire was basically divided up to the victors. Britain got Palestine, Egypt, France got Syria, and I don't remember what other countries, but the French and the British were able to go in there, and they began to have a tremendous amount of influence right after World War I. Britain, 1917 is when the British also... The Balfour Declaration was in 1917 when the British gave Israel the right to become a nation again, or at least they gave their approval to Israel becoming a nation, because now Britain was the protector of those lands after World War I. So, but within a few years, the caliphate, which was the Muslim authority that was centered in Turkey, dissolved also. In 1924, Turkey became a secular republic, no longer a Muslim country under Sharia law. It became a republic. They elected a secular president. and the caliphate ended. In Muslim history, if you go on Muslim websites, they show the four caliphates, one right after the other, from Muhammad all the way up to 1924, and then it ended. 632 AD from the time of Muhammad to the 1924, a continual Muslim authority in the world that every Muslim could look to. From 1924 until the present, no caliphate. You wonder, like, what's the big deal about these guys in the Middle East right now, ISIS, who are trying to establish a world caliphate? They're actually attempting to reestablish the Ottoman caliphate. In their writings, all they're trying to do is to revive the last caliphate, this worldwide Muslim government, which ended in 1924. So that's going to become important in a little bit. So keep those things in mind. All right. The last time we looked at this, we don't have time tonight to go back to Psalm 83, but if you weren't here for those studies, you should make a note of it. Psalm 83 and Ezekiel chapter 38 and chapter 39. Why are those chapters significant? They talk about nations that come against Israel in the last days. Does anybody remember the one common characteristic of every nation mentioned in those three chapters? What was the common characteristic of all of those nations in those three chapters, which all prophesy nations coming against Israel and ultimately being defeated? What was the one thing all those nations had in common? Anybody remember? They're all Muslim nations today. Every one of them is a Muslim nation today, right? Which becomes pretty important. The goal of Islam, there's no secret, the goal of Islam today is world government, a caliphate, a world caliphate. Their goal is a one world language, Arabic. Their goal is a one world religion, Islam. There is one method of establishing that: war, the sword, bloodshed. That has been the way of Islam from the beginning, right? So if their goal is a world government, their goal is a world religion, their goal is one world language, Arabic, the way to accomplish that is through war. But since 1924, their fortunes have not been, you know, too great. But they are slowly, as you can see, if you pay any attention at all, they are so slowly rebuilding their strength and their influence all around the world through infiltration, through assimilation, through internal evidence. A part of their goal to establish a world caliphate is to become a part of the major countries around the world that could ever be a problem to them, and then slowly being a part of that from within and influencing it from within. Do you know that every passage in the Bible that shows, that mentions the nations that Jesus Christ will fight when he returns, every one of those nations that are mentioned in the Bible that are at war with Jesus Christ when he returns are today Muslim nations? Every nation in the Bible or city in the Bible that is ever condemned by the Lord to destruction is a Muslim nation. Now, Rome, the city of Rome is mentioned 16 times in the Bible. And do you know that not one time is Rome ever condemned to destruction, the city of Rome? But every nation or city that is mentioned in the Bible as being destroyed one day by the Lord is today a Muslim country. Show you just a few quick examples of this. Go to Isaiah chapter 19. Isaiah chapter 19. And almost any book of prophecy that you want to open, look at the cities or countries that are mentioned in that, and it becomes pretty clear who the enemies of Israel will be in the last days and who the enemies of the Lord will be primarily in the last days. Isaiah chapter 19. Look at verse number 1. The burden of Egypt. Behold, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence. The hearts of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight everyone against his brother, everyone against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. And the spirit of Egypt shall fail, etc., etc. We don't have to go all the way down through these things. Go over to verse number 17 in that same chapter. Verse number 17. And the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. Every one that maketh mention thereof shall be afraid in himself because of the counsel of the Lord of hosts, which he hath determined against it. In that day, five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan. Canaan is present-day Palestine, the Palestinians and such. Swear to the Lord of hosts, one shall be called the city of destruction. In that day shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. It shall be a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt, etc. It goes on. But it shows the Lord, when he returns, fighting against the country of Egypt. Go over to Zechariah. Zechariah. We literally would not have time if we spent the next month every night looking at all the prophecies in the Bible that mention countries that today are all Muslim. Zechariah chapter 9. Skip down to verse number 12. Turn you to the stronghold, ye prisoners of hope. Even today I declare that I will render double unto thee. When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece. Now, Greece in this sense, remember when Alexander the Great conquered, conquered the Middle East, he ruled all the way from Macedonia, all the way to India, up into the stands, Kazakhstan, and I don't know, there's six or seven of them up in there. His kingdom extended up into there, north of India, and all the way down into Egypt. So Alexander the Great's empire later became the Ottoman Empire. In fact, today the Turkish president's symbol is the star of Alexander the Great. It's the Macedonian star. So the old Greek Empire is really became the Ottoman Empire. They covered the same borders. So when God is speaking against Greece, he's not speaking against the Greece today that you and I would know, but against the kingdom of Alexander the Great, which was from Macedonia all the way to Egypt. That was Greece. And the Greek language was spread through all of that area also. Alexandria, Egypt, was named after Alexander and was primarily settled by Greeks. So his influence was all through that part of the world. But when Alexander's empire fell apart after his death, you remember that it was broken into four. Just like the book of Daniel said, the book of Daniel prophesied that Alexander's empire would break into four parts, and out of those four parts, out of one of those four parts, would rise the Antichrist in the book of Daniel. So Alexander's empire fell apart into one of his generals. Ptolemy took the south, which would have been from Palestine down to Egypt. Another general, Seleucus, took the northern part of the Middle East, which was Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Turkey. Seleucus took that whole part. Ptolemy took the south. Seleucus took the north. And two of his other generals split up the western end of Turkey and Greece and Macedonia. So four generals, four parts to his empire. Well, in the book of Daniel, chapter 11, Daniel describes the future wars between the one he calls the king of the south, which would have been Ptolemy, and the king of the north, which would have been Seleucus, as they fought back and forth in Daniel chapter 11. So in Daniel chapter 11, the king of the north and the king of the south continued to war against each other for hundreds of years after the death of Alexander. Daniel prophesied that in Daniel chapter 11. And the king of the north, in Daniel chapter 11, about halfway through that chapter, slowly transforms into, the description of him, there's a transformation in the description, and halfway through Daniel chapter 11, that king of the north becomes the Antichrist. So just as Daniel prophesied, the Antichrist would come out of one of those four horns, one of those four parts, and the king of the north in Daniel chapter 11, which would have been the king who governed Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Seleucus and all of his descendants. The Antichrist would come from that area. So here, God's judgment against Greece is not the country of Greece that you and I would know today, but that country as it was, that kingdom as it was in the days of this prophet. And it says, and it goes on down through here. So that Greece there would be what for us today would be Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Go to Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11. Let's look at verse 1, Isaiah chapter 11. we'll skip down toward the end of this, just in the interest of time. But it's speaking about the Lord Jesus Christ, the root that comes forth, the rod that comes forth out of Jesse. Jesse was David's father. Jesus Christ is called the Son of David. And verse number 10, for example, in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people, to which shall the Gentiles seek. And then it describes, and it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall, and that is when at the coming of Jesus Christ, which shall be left from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, which is southern Egypt, from Cush, which is Sudan today, from Elam. The Elamites, if you look on a map, are where present-day Persia is. So that's Persia. From Shinar, which would be, remember that Nebuchadnezzar set up his image in the kingdom of Babylon in the plains of Shinar. So that would be Iraq. From Hamath. Hamath is western Syria and Lebanon and part of southern Turkey. But the point is, all of those nations at the time of the Lord's return are today Muslim nations. All right, so there's definitely something there that's important to consider. Here's something else. And I guess I've heard this my whole life that I've been saved and probably taught it many times. In the book of Revelation, chapter 16, let's go there real quick. The book of Revelation, chapter 16, one of the prophecies concerning the last days is that during the tribulation, Revelation 16 and verse number 12, it says, "The sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared." The kings of the east. I guess every message I've ever heard on prophecy, and even a few tracks, including the Jack Chick track. There's a Chick track about, you know, the coming of the Antichrist, and likens or relates the kings of the East to either being China or Korea or Japan. Those would be the kings of the East. That the Euphrates River is going to be dried up, and the kings of the East, China or the Orientals in the Far East, would be a part of this army coming down into the Middle East to conquer Israel. But it seems, you know, now that I'm looking at this in the last few months with like maybe a different set of, from a different viewpoint, with the rise of militant Islam, it pays to just take another look at who the kings of the East really are by using the Bible to define who the kings of the East are. The kings of the East, this book is a book about the Middle East. You know, we read it as Americans, and we try and relate everything to America. But you can't understand this book unless you understand that God has his eyes on Israel. God measures everything from Israel. Israel is the center of God's world, not New York, not Washington, D.C. Us and our country and democracy and everything could be irrelevant to all these prophecies. Because when God is speaking about things, he may not be speaking about Russia, China, Korea, or Japan. He's speaking about that world of the Bible. So can we look in the scriptures and find out where the kings of the East are according to the scriptures. So I just did a little study on just that very thing. And I want to that's just one of the little points tonight, and it's all going in the same direction. But go with me. Let's go back and look and see if we can find out who the kings of the East are. Go back to Genesis chapter 29. 29 verse 1. Genesis 29 and verse 1. Here's the first mention of any such place or people. It's talking about Jacob. Jacob went on his journey. Anybody remember where Jacob went and why? Remember, Jacob went on a journey to get a wife. And he traveled. He didn't travel to China to get a wife. He didn't go to Korea or Japan. But he went into the land of the people of the East. Right? He went no further than Iraq. He went no further than the land of his ancestor. You know, his grandfather, Abraham, was from Ur of the Chaldeans, right? Chaldeans, the Babylonians, the Middle East, around the Euphrates and the Tigris River, right? Go to the book of Numbers, chapter 23. Anybody remember Balaam the prophet? Well, Balaam, in Numbers chapter 23, tells you where he was from. Numbers chapter 23. And we just recently just reread these three chapters, 22, 23, 24. I would encourage you to do the same, because these prophecies made by a false prophet. Balaam was a false prophet, and yet God forced Balaam to speak the truth. Balak, the king, had hired Balaam to curse the children of Israel for him, because Balak, the king of Moab, had seen the children of Israel coming out of Egypt, cross the Red Sea, conquering all their enemies. He got afraid, and he figured the only way to defeat these people is to get God to kill them. So he hired a prophet, a famous prophet apparently, because he sent his most noble leaders in his country all the way to another country to hire Balaam. So he must have had some reputation. He must have had, maybe he could see things, had visions, they came true. So he had a reputation. Balak spent all this money to try to get Balak to come to him so that he could curse the Israelites and so that God would destroy them. So Balaam came and he wanted to get paid, but God would not let him curse Israel. Every time he tried, four times in these three chapters, Balaam tried, wanted to curse Israel, but every time God made him open his mouth and pronounce a blessing on them. And Balaam actually prophesied the coming of Jesus Christ. He prophesied the victory of Jesus Christ over all of Israel's enemies. It's in his prophecy here. And he wasn't even a good man. But notice where he was from. It says in verse number 7, chapter 23 and verse 7, and he, this is Balaam, took up this his parable and said, Balak, the king of Moab, hath brought me from Aram. Aram. Now, Aram, in any map, probably in your Bible, any map of those days, Aram is today Syria. In fact, the Aramaic language is Syrian. It was later called Syriac. So, on a map where you would, you know, find Syria, just northeast of Israel, was ancient Aram. Balaam was a Syrian. He was from the land of Aram, out of the mountains of what? The east. Same area that Jacob went to look for a wife, in the land of the people of the east. All right, so here, it's not calling China the east or Korea the east. It just meant east of Israel. And as far as God was concerned, God ignores China in the Bible, by the way, right? Have you seen any of China's history in there? No. You know, have you seen any of Russia's history in there? No. Have you seen any, you know, of America or South America? No one's history matters to God in the scriptures except those nations that came in contact with his people. It's the only ones that get any attention in the scriptures, right? Because that's what God's focus was on there, right? So Balaam wasn't from China or Korea. He was from Syria in the mountains of the east. All right, go to the book of Job. The book of Job. Just before the book of Psalms, Job chapter 1. Okay, Job chapter 1, verse number 3. Job chapter 1, verse number 3. Speaking about Job, it says his substance was 7,000, this and that. Look at the last line of verse number 3. This man was the greatest of all the men of the east. Well, okay, so where was the east? Job is the greatest man of all the men of the east. We'll go up to verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz. Okay, so Uz was the east. Well, where is Uz? Well, if you go back to, you don't have to turn there, but you can mark it down if you care to look at it later. Uz, you know how people in the Bible, God even said in the book of Psalms, they call their lands after themselves, you know, they name their lands after themselves. The land of Uz was the land settled by a man named Uz. Uz happened to be the son of Aram, Genesis chapter 10, verse 23. Aram, the same one for whom Aram is named, the land of Aram, all right, Syria. Well, Uz was Aram's son in Genesis chapter 10, verse 23, all right? But that alone perhaps is not enough evidence to let you know where Uz was, all right? Let's look at a few other verses. We're going to find out where Uz is. And Job is the biggest guy in Uz, the most important guy in the east. All right. Look in Lamentations chapter 4. We're just going to see if we can find out where Uz is. Lamentations chapter 4. Lamentations chapter 4. Let's go down to verse number 21. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, that dwellest in the land of Uz. So Uz and Edom are the same. Anybody remember where Edom is? The Edomites lived east of the Jordan River. That would be present-day Jordan, right? So Edom dwelled, you know, before Edom took up that place. The Edomites settled there, but before it was Edom, it was Uz. Edom dwells in the land of Uz. The cup also shall pass through unto thee, etc. All right? That's one verse. Go to Jeremiah. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 25. Jeremiah chapter 25. Jeremiah 25, go to verse number 15. For thus saith the Lord God of Israel unto me, take the wine cup of this fury at my hand, and cause all the nations to whom I send thee to drink it. And they shall drink, and be moved, and be mad, because of the sword that I will send among them. This is actually, we're going to read a few verses here. This is actually a very important prophecy. God sent Jeremiah. Whether Jeremiah literally traveled around to all these countries with a cup, I don't know. But God prophetically told Jeremiah, this cup represents his fury, God's fury and anger against these nations that he's going to mention here. And that God intends, as you'll see, we're going to read about eight verses, and you'll see that God intends that God himself, he told Jeremiah, I want you to go around and let all of these nations know my judgment is coming, that they will drink from the cup of my fury, all right? And so I don't know how Jeremiah fulfilled that command. I don't know if he went to the capitals of all those countries and, you know, traveled there and stood in the center of town or in the, you know, in the front of the palace or whatever in each of those countries and just declared the word of the Lord. How he made, but God told him, I want you to make these nations drink from this cup. How he did that, I don't know. But God, if Jeremiah traveled, physically traveled to all those countries, then God considered the presence of his prophet in that country and the declaration that he made against that country as to be that nation drinking from that cup. And so, but look at the countries. It says, and this is where Jeremiah was supposed to go. Pharaoh, king of Egypt. and his servants. Verse 20, and all the mingled people and all the kings of the land of Uz and all the kings of the land of the Philistines and Ashkelon and Azza and Ekron and Ashdod. By the way, those are all peoples right around Israel, close to Israel. And Edom, verse 21, Moab, Ammon, verse 22, all the kings of Tyrus, all the kings of Zidon, Dedan, Tema, that's Yemen, and Buz, and these are all nations that today are all in that Middle East area. And before there was Saudi Arabia, that's a relatively modern country. Before there was one big country called Saudi Arabia, the Arabians living in that peninsula, there were numerous nations there in the Bible times. And these are some of their names. Dedan, Tema, Buz, and all the kings of Arabia. So it just sort of encompasses them all. And all the kings of the mingled people. All right? The mingled people, that's interesting, that dwell in the desert. And all the kings of Zimri and all the kings of Elam, that's Persia, and the kings of the Medes and the kings of the north, which would be, as we said before, Syria, Turkey, Iraq, and near and all the kingdoms of the world. It spreads out to the whole world there. But and then it says at the last of verse number 26, the king of Shishak. Shishak, if you want to make a note, make a cross-reference, Jeremiah 51, verse 41, Shishak is just another word for Babylon, which is Iraq. Every one of those countries to which Jeremiah was told, take this cup, let them know, warn them, my fury is coming, my judgment is coming, they will drink from this cup. Every one of them are the nations right now that are in the news every day. Those are all Muslim countries. Today, from Egypt in verse 19 to Iraq in verse number 26. Every single one of them are those nations right around Israel today that have been throughout history her enemies. So, and this is a prophecy that will be fulfilled in the future. But in that list of countries is Uz. So you see that, so Job was the greatest man of the men of the East. And he wasn't from China or Korea. He was from the Middle East. And when the Euphrates River is dried up so that the kings of the East can come against Israel in greater strength. It goes on. I don't want to just bore you with this, but I'm just trying to make a case for perhaps in these last days an Islamic Antichrist, rather than that, but that the beast himself may not be the European Union or the former Roman Empire revived, but perhaps actually an Islamic Antichrist and that seven-headed beast that's described in the book of Revelation may actually be in its present or in its present and future identification be an Islamic beast. Let's look at a few more verses. We're looking at the men of the East. Go to Ezekiel chapter 25. Ezekiel chapter 25. Ezekiel 25, we'll go quick, verse 2. Ezekiel 25, 2. Son of man, set thy face against the Ammonites. Verse 3, say unto the Ammonites, hear the word of the Lord God. Skip down through here. Behold, therefore, the Ammonites, the children of Ammon, were in near present-day Jordan. Anybody know the capital of the country of Jordan? Ammon. The Ammonites were there. The city's named after them. All right, so Ammon, Jordan, is where the Ammonites in history lived. So it's just east of Israel. It says, but notice, therefore I will deliver thee, the Ammonites, to the men of the east for a possession. So in other words, the Ammonites, the Jordanians, would be conquered by men further east from them. So God is prophesying that the Ammonites would one day be overthrown and be given to the men of the east. They shall set their palaces in thee and make their dwellings in thee. They shall eat thy fruit and they shall drink thy milk. Skip down to verse 9. Now God is speaking to Moab and Seir. Mount Seir and Moab are both in southern Jordan and into like more on the border of southern Jordan and Arabia, Saudi Arabia. Behold, the house of Judah is like unto all the heathen. Therefore, behold, I will open the side of Moab from the cities, from his cities which are on his frontiers, the glory of the country, Beth Shemoth, Baal Meon, and Kiriath-Theim, unto the men of the east with the Ammonites, and I will give them in possession that the Ammonites may not be remembered among the nations. So here Moab suffers the same fate. The Ammonites, which would have been north of Moab, and the Moabites, so both of them together would be present-day Jordan, are going to be given as a possession to men east of them. All right? It doesn't seem to indicate the Chinese or the Koreans, but it seems to be somebody is going to overthrow Jordan, and God is prophesying that they're going to be overthrown by men of the east. Go to Isaiah chapter 27. Isaiah 27. Look at verse number 8. Isaiah 27, 8. Oh, I think I might have the wrong, written down the wrong verse here, because that is not. Isaiah 27, 8, that's not the verse I want. All right. It's speaking about Abraham. And in and I don't remember where it is, but it calls Abraham the righteous man from the east. And I wrote down the wrong verse there. Abraham, the righteous man from the east. The verse isn't important, but Abraham was called the man from the east. Anybody you know where Abraham was from? Ur of the Chaldeans, right? Which was very, very east of Israel. And God brought him from the east to the west. Go to Isaiah chapter 46. I hope I got this verse right. Isaiah 46. What was it? Was the man from the east? All right, you know what, Bobby? Since you got it, let's go read it. 41:2. Isaiah 41:2. Who raised up the righteous man from the east. How do we know this is Abraham? Look at the rest of the verse. Called him to his foot, gave the nations before him, and made him rule over kings. All right, and certainly Abraham did that. If you go back and read Genesis chapter 14, you'll see that Abraham went to war with 318 of his servants and conquered nations with those servants. He went to war and he won. So this righteous man from the east was Abraham. And he didn't come from China. He came from Babylon. He came from from Ur of the Chaldeans. So no, not much further than eastern Iraq is where Abraham originally came from. Okay? So he was a man from the east. Go to Isaiah 46, verse 11. Isaiah 46, 11. This happens to be speaking about Cyrus. You remember that in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah prophesied about Cyrus hundreds of years before Cyrus was even born. But here in Isaiah chapter 46 in verse number 11, God is speaking about, in chapter 45, I think is where, check and see if that's, yes, chapter 45 is where he names Cyrus. 45:1, thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus. Cyrus wasn't even born yet. Cyrus was born hundreds of years after this prophecy. But God, just showing you that he knows the future from the beginning, God is foretelling the coming of this man, Cyrus. Why was Cyrus important? Because it was Babylon that took the Jews captive, and God prophesied that one would come from the east and overthrow Babylon. That was Cyrus. And that Cyrus would be the one who would release the Jews out of captivity so they could go back to their land. So in chapter 45 and chapter 46, the theme that God is mainly focused on Cyrus. And notice what he calls him in verse number 11 of chapter 46. Calling a ravenous bird, this is Cyrus, from the east. the man that executeth my counsel from a far country. Yea, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, I will also do it. So God is prophesying that even though this man hasn't even been born yet, he will come, he will conquer Babylon, and he'll set up the Medo-Persian Empire. But here God calls him a ravenous bird from the east who's going to come and do the will of God and overthrow the Babylonian Empire. All right, let's see. One last one on this. Go to Jeremiah chapter 49. Jeremiah chapter 49. Jeremiah chapter 49 and verse number 28. By the way, here in Jeremiah chapter 49, you see the Ammonites mentioned in verse 1. You see the Edomites mentioned in verse number 7. So all through here, God is talking about Edom and Ammon. And he gets down to verse number 28. And Damascus is mentioned in verse 23. And in verse 28, it says, concerning Kedar. Kedar is another one of those Arabian nations. Before there was a Saudi Arabia in modern times, in that land in those days were numerous nations. One of them was Kedar. Kedar himself was the second son of Ishmael. And he's pretty interesting to the Muslims because they claim that Muhammad is descended from Kedar. That Muhammad is in the direct lineage from Ishmael's son, Kedar. But Kedar is in present-day Arabia. So God is saying, concerning Kedar and concerning the kingdoms of Hazor. Hazor is also another one of those nations, a region in the Arabian desert east of the Jordan River. Concerning Kedar and concerning the kingdoms of Hazor, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, shall smite, thus saith the Lord, arise ye, go up to Kedar, and spoil the men of the east. All right? So God is calling Kedar and Hazor, he's calling these nations the men of the east. So every reference in the Bible to the men of the east, the children of the east, we didn't even look at that. There's a number of verses that speak about the children of the east, the land of the east, the mountains of the east, the kings of the east are mentioned in Jeremiah chapter 25, the kings of the east. So in Revelation 16, when God says he dries up the Euphrates River, which I always wondered, you know, if the kings of the east were China, there are a lot bigger bodies of water in their way rather than the Euphrates River before the Chinese got to Israel. I mean, they got a couple of oceans in their way and a lot of rivers in their way. Why the Euphrates? So the Euphrates River being dried up means that people east of the Euphrates River, which would be present-day what nation? Iran. The strongest Shiite country in the world. One of the nuclear Muslim nations, you know, on the verge of getting nuclear weapons. And God says the Euphrates River is going to dry up because Iran, the kings of the east, are going to be involved in coming in against Israel in the last days. All right? Am I getting you interested yet? Okay. All right. Okay. Let's see. I got so much stuff here, but I got to just pick through it. And there was a couple of other things I wanted to give you tonight before we run out of time. Oh, let's go to Revelation chapter 17. Let's do this one real quick. I might not even get to the Quran tonight. I don't think we're going to have time, but go to Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17 speaks about the seven heads of that beast. All right? Revelation chapter 17. John is describing the kingdoms of the kingdoms that this beast have, these world powers that have had an influence over Israel, right? Because that's what matters. I mean, there might have been greater empires, you know, the Chinese Empire, there might have been, you know, whatever. The Mongol Empire, you know, from Mongolia and all of that. You know, those might have been fierce, great empires, but God is only interested in those empires that had any, that in any way harmed his people Israel. they get honorable mention in the scriptures. Right? So when John is seeing this beast with these seven heads, then obviously it has to be empires that have had an effect on Israel. So in Revelation chapter 17, look at verse number 9. Here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains. Right? This does not mean the city of Rome. Rome was not built on seven mountains. It might have been built on seven hills. By the way, do you know the one other city in the world that is built on seven hills? And this particular city has on the top of each one of those seven hills a great mosque. The city of Istanbul is built on seven hills. And on the top of each one of those hills, you can check it out for yourself, on the top of each one of those hills is a great mosque. And by the way, the city of Istanbul is built on something called the Golden Horn. It's a peninsula. And the bay of water that is nearby is called the Little Horn. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? But anyway, and the Antichrist is called a Little Horn. But anyway, here, let's go. It says, verse 9, here's the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains. Now in the scriptures, mountains represent kingdoms. So this beast has had his influence on this earth through seven kingdoms, in seven kingdoms, on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. Verse 10 is important. Five are fallen. In John's day, five kingdoms, five world kingdoms had fallen. They would have been Egypt, Assyria. Egypt attacked Israel more than once. Assyria attacked Israel more than once. So Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, because Babylon conquered Assyria. Then Persia. Persia conquered Babylon. And Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire conquered Persia and took over the entire Middle East. So five, in John's day when he was writing this, five had already fallen. He said, five are fallen and one is. So which one was controlling the world in John's day? The Roman Empire, which had conquered the Greek Empire. So five are fallen, one is the Roman Empire. Now watch this. And the other is not yet come. Now, in my thinking, for many, many years, the one that was not yet come in John's day was the mystery Babylon Holy Roman Empire religion. That's what I thought. I guess every book I ever got my hands on said so. I repeated it. And so that the Roman Empire continued in its seventh form in this Holy Roman Empire, and then out of that seventh comes the eighth, which is the kingdom of the Antichrist. That's what Revelation 17 says. So the standard understanding is Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. Rome fell and is replaced by Holy Rome, Holy Roman Empire. And out of that seventh, the Holy Roman Empire, comes the Antichrist. But the Holy Roman Empire didn't conquer the Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire, which was the reign of the popes and the European kings, Charlemagne and all those guys, the Frankish kings from Europe and all that, you know. But anyway, they didn't conquer the Roman Empire. They may have been an aberration that grew out of the Roman Empire, but who actually conquered the Roman Empire? It wasn't the Goths or the Visigoths or the barbarians. Now, they decimated Rome, but they didn't conquer the Roman Empire. The only people that conquered the Roman Empire and caused its end were the Ottomans in 1453. Because the capital of the Roman Empire moved from Rome to Constantinople and continued, the Roman Empire continued in the east for 1,000 years until 1453. So the one that is, that John is speaking about, is the Roman Empire, and it didn't come to an end in the 4th century. That it continued until 1453, and it, like all of its predecessors, was overthrown, was conquered. The Ottoman Empire put an end to the Byzantine Empire. The Roman Empire collapsed militarily, politically. There was no more Roman emperor. The Roman emperor who was living in Constantinople at the time when it was besieged by the Muslims, by the Ottomans, died, was killed. There were no more Roman empires or any more Roman emperors after 1453. So I'm just suggesting that perhaps the seventh that John is talking about here, which he says, look at verse 10, when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven and goeth into perdition. So the eighth has to come out of its predecessor. Right? So in our thinking, the Antichrist has to come out of the Holy Roman Empire. But the Holy Roman Empire never conquered the Roman Empire. The Ottoman Caliphate, which men are attempting right now to reestablish and having some success in the Middle East at doing so, that Ottoman Empire conquered the Roman Empire. And according, if that, you know, I was just suggesting this perhaps, then the eighth, which would be the kingdom of the Antichrist, comes out of the seven, out of all seven, the same spirit of all seven, but obviously most out of its predecessor. Because each one that conquered took many of the characteristics of its immediate predecessor. Right? The Assyrians took many of the characteristics of the Egyptians. The Babylonians took many of the characteristics of the Assyrians. The Persians took many characteristics of the Babylonians. And so the Romans took many characteristics of the Greek. They took the art of the Greeks. They took, you know, so each kingdom that conquered its predecessor still has some of the attributes of its immediate predecessor. So the eighth would be of the seven and would have many of the attributes of the eighth would have many of the attributes of the seventh, which I'm not sure I'm so convinced that it's the Holy Roman Empire any longer, but it may actually be a Muslim empire that ruled the world for 500 years, controlled the Middle East, which is the part of the world that the Lord cares about the most. It controlled that part of the world up until 1917, which is a pretty important date also as it pertains to Israel. And the Ottoman Empire conquered Jerusalem in 1517, as we also said, as we already said. 1517 is important for another reason. Does anybody remember anything else that pretty important that happened in 1517? That was the same year that the Reformation began. Luther nailed his 95 theses, you know, to the church door at Wittenberg in 1517, and it was on. That was on. Now there was a legitimate uprising. There was a real uprising in Germany against the power of the Roman Catholic Church. And by the way, do you know who Martin Luther, not that he's any authority or on any of this, but you know who Martin Luther thought the beast was going to be? Islam. 1517, Luther wrote that the beast was not the Roman Empire. I mean, and if anybody would have had an axe to grind against the Holy Roman Empire and the Catholic Church, it would have been Luther. But Luther said the beast would be Islam, and in particular, the country of Turkey. That's pretty interesting. But some strange stuff. Does anybody remember where the Garden of Eden would have been? All right. Well, Eden compassed more than a garden, because the Bible says in Genesis chapter 2 that God planted a garden in the eastern part of Eden, east in Eden. But the garden in eastern Eden was watered by a river that flowed out of Eden. So the Garden of Eden was a garden in an area called Eden. And the garden in Genesis chapter 2, verse 8, is watered by a river that flows out of Eden. And that river broke into four. But does anybody remember one of those rivers? The Euphrates. So if you look on a map at where does the trace the Euphrates River back to where it starts? Turkey. That's pretty interesting. You know that the seven churches in the book of Revelation, chapter 2 and chapter 3, are all today, are all located, which are tribulation churches, are all located on a map in present day Turkey. And one of those cities, the city of Pergamos, is where the Bible said Satan's seat is Pergamos. And since that's a prophetic book speaking about the tribulation, in the tribulation, according to Revelation chapter 2, Satan's seat will be in Pergamos. Anybody, you can find it on a map. Where is Pergamos? In Turkey. So Satan's seat in the tribulation is not going to be Rome. It's going to be somewhere in Turkey. The Garden of Eden was where Satan's first seat was, because after Adam got kicked out, guess who moved in? So Satan ruled in the beginning from Eden. Anybody remember in the book of Isaiah and in Ezekiel, where it speaks about the king of Babylon, and in Ezekiel chapter 28 speaks about the king of Tyrus, Tyre, a Muslim area, and God says concerning the king of Tyrus, which is Satan, thou wast in Eden. You were in Eden. That's where you started, in Eden. So Eden was Turkey, or Eden was located in, if you look on a map, it would be in present day Turkey. Pretty interesting stuff, isn't it? And the Bible says in Revelation chapter 13, verse 2, that Satan gives his seat to the Antichrist. The only seat that Satan ever had in the scriptures that we can locate as an actual city was Pergamos. Revelation 13, 2, Satan gives his power and his seat to the Antichrist. Okay, all right. Are you interested yet now? Okay. All right, let's see. I got one more thing to show you. All right, one more thing. Go to the book of 1 John. 1 John. We'll develop this a little further the next time, I guess, because we're running out of time. But 1 John, the only place the word Antichrist is mentioned in the Bible is in 1 John and 2 John. And it tells you what the spirit of Antichrist is. Look in 1 John chapter 4. Let's go there first. It's mentioned in chapter 2 also, but I want you to see chapter 4 first. 1 John chapter 4, verse number... 1 John chapter 4, what do I want? Verse number 3. Okay, 1 John chapter 4, verse number 3. And every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist, whereof ye have heard that it should come, and even now already is it in the world. So God is going to tell you what the main driving, the main spirit behind Antichrist and his kingdom. God is telling you what it's all about right here, is that he's going to deny that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh. All right, go over to chapter 2, verse 18. 1 John chapter 2, verse 18. Look at little children, it is the last time, and as ye have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists, whereby ye know that it is the last time. All right, now go to chapter 2, look down in verse number 22. Who is a liar but he that denieth that Jesus is the Christ? He is Antichrist. He is Antichrist that denieth the Father and the Son. Whosoever denieth the Son, the same hath not the Father. But he that acknowledgeth the Son hath the Father also. Go over to 2 John, the book of 2 John. And look at chapter 1, verse 7. For many deceivers are entered into the world, who confess not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. Well, what two things do we learn from those four verses? That antichrist and that spirit, everybody associated with him, wherever that spirit is found, even in many antichrists, these two characteristics. The spirit of antichrist denies the Father and the Son and denies that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh. Now I ask you a question. Does Roman Catholicism deny the Father and the Son? No. Does Roman Catholicism deny that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh? No. What religion denies the Father and the Son? Islam. What religion denies, they don't deny that Jesus came in the flesh, but he was just a prophet. They deny that Jesus, the Christ, the anointed of God, the Son of God, came in the flesh. The spirit of Antichrist is not in Europe. Because, I mean, that doesn't mean that Catholicism is good doctrine, but it just means That's not what God was talking about in these verses. Catholicism doesn't fit that. But there is one religion that fits that dramatically. In fact, it is one of their creeds, is that God, Allah, to them, did not have a son. In fact, the first holy, the holiest statement in Islam, in fact, when they make a convert, you know, you see them, if you've, you know, when they overrun a town and they force people to convert to Islam, to become a Muslim, all you have to do is repeat that creed. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet or messenger. To repeat that out loud, according to them, and you see some videos of them, usually some poor guy is doing it at the point of a sword, is that as soon as you say that, you're now a Muslim, according to them. That's their declaration of faith. And that is the holiest statement, the first holiest statement to a Muslim, is that Allah is God, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. Right? And that you'll see, it's written everywhere. It's written on their headbands. The Palestinians have that written on their headband. That's the statement that's everywhere. The second holiest statement, which they also wear on their forehead, is Allah is not begotten, neither does he beget. That is written around the top of the Dome of the Rock. That state, Allah is not begotten, neither does he beget. And that is repeated every day in their daily prayers. When a Muslim prays and bows toward Mecca, he must say that in his prayers every day. Allah is not begotten, neither does he beget. Every time they pray, they deny the Father and the Son. Every single time they pray, they deny the Father and the Son. He that denieth the Father and the Son, this is the spirit of Antichrist. So there's some... We're going to look at that a little bit more. I don't have enough time because I got several. I want to go into that one a little bit more, but we just don't have time to finish that tonight. Let me just see if I had actually written down the Arabic statement itself. Anyway. I'll just read them. We don't have time to turn to the Quran. There's many in the Quran, but here's a few of them. Surah, that's their chapters. Surah 4, verse number 171. The Messiah, Jesus, the son of Mary, was no more than God's apostle. God is but one God. God forbid that he should have a son. Surah 10, 68. They say God has begotten a son. God forbid. Self-sufficient is he. Surah 17, verse 111. Say... Praise be to God who has never begotten a son, who has no partner in his kingdom. In the Quran, chapter 19, verse 29, God forbid that he himself should beget a son. Chapter 19, verse 88, those who say the Lord of mercy has begotten a son preach a monstrous falsehood at which the very heavens might crack. Chapter 43, verse 72, say, if the Lord of mercy had a son, I would be the first to worship him. Those were the words of Muhammad. But Islam, what is blasphemous to us is holy to them. What is holy to them is blasphemous to us. One last thought. In the Quran, chapter 27, verse 82, you know what? I think I'll read this one to you. Let's see if I can find that real quick. 27, we'll end with this one. 27. There's 26. 27. 82. Now remember, this is supposedly Allah speaking. And when the word is fulfilled against them, it's talking about the wicked of the world. It says, and when the word is fulfilled against them, the unjust, we, Allah speaks of himself in the plural, we shall produce from the earth a beast to face them. He will speak to them for that mankind did not believe with assurance in our signs. One day we shall gather together from every people a troop of those who reject our signs, and they shall be kept in ranks. And explain. Now, in the Quran, Allah says He will raise up a beast in the earth. And the explanation of that verse by Islamic authorities is this. That beast is called Dabat al-Ard in Islamic commentaries on the Quran. And it is that Allah will raise a beast in the earth who will mark all Muslims in their forehead. And in their forehead, the words in Arabic, destined for paradise. And will mark all unbelievers in their forehead.